From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. A while back on this program, we heard the news that global carbon emissions seemed to be ready to peak. That was the message from Neil Grant, a senior climate and energy analyst at Climate Analytics. And a big part of this argument is efficiency. We're getting more and more efficient about how we're turning fossil fuels into energy at the same time that we're bringing more and more renewables like wind and solar online. But in his new book, A Climate of Truth, Mike Berners-Lee points out that efficiency doesn't actually have a good track record at making us use less. It just makes using more cheaper. And as a result of this, we're still emitting lots of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And even if we do peak, technically, we're not on track for the reductions that we need to slow global warming. And this is just one of the key examples of why Berners-Lee says we can't just keep doing things the same way we've been doing them. We have to think differently, and we have to solve problems differently. Mike Berners-Lee is a leading thinker, a researcher, a best-selling author, and a consultant on carbon footprint, sustainability, and climate change. He's a professor at Lancaster University and the director of Small World Consulting, a company that helps organizations address their environmental impact. And his past books include How Bad Are Bananas, which is a guide to understanding the climate impact of everyday actions and products, The Burning Question, which was an exploration of why carbon emissions keep rising despite efforts to curb them, and There Is No Planet B, which looked at how humanity can thrive within environmental limits, covering economics, food systems, and ethics. In the new book, Berners-Lee argues that the biggest thing we're missing if we want to solve this problem is something that we are woefully lacking. It's the acknowledgement of the fundamental importance of truth. Mike Berners-Lee, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Mike, early into this book, you write that our problems turn out to be more or less solvable from a technical perspective. I don't think most people recognize this, and it should be good news. We mostly know how to solve this problem. That's great. But in a lot of ways, as I reflected on that, it seems to make things even more depressing. Because if we know how to solve these problems, why the heck aren't we? And I know you've done a lot of reflecting on that. Like, what fundamentally is wrong with the human species that is causing us to have the solutions but not be able to implement them?
I mean, if only this was just a technology problem. We have all the technology we need, for example, for an energy transition. There are a few little bits that are still tricky. We don't know how to put airplanes in the sky for long-haul flights yet. And we've still got some, it's a bit tricky doing all the storage of renewable energy that we need and all the transport of it. But, you know, none of these things are stopping us from making absolutely enormous strides to reduce our fossil fuel extraction. And yet we're not doing so. And actually, just to pick up from your introduction about the role of efficiency is the means by which we have come to the position where our global emissions are so high. If we'd never learned to be so efficient in our use of fossil fuel, we would never have managed to grow the economy to the point that we're using so much of it. I know that sounds, you know, slightly contradictory to some people. It's a little bit counterintuitive. But actually, the way the dynamics of the system work is that the more efficient we become at practically anything, the more we do of that thing.
And this isn't just when we talk about carbon. I mean, like, so this is something that's been described in the past as the Jevons paradox. It's been observed in many ways.
Yeah, so it's called the Jevons paradox sometimes because William Stanley Jevons observed in the 19th century in the UK that as we became more efficient with our use of coal, we would want more coal, not less. And it doesn't just apply to coal. It doesn't just apply to energy. And the trouble is that unless we constrain the inputs, such as fossil fuel use, what we find is that as we get more efficient, we actually use more energy and at the moment still more fossil fuel, despite or possibly even because of the efficiency improvement.
There's a really beautiful sort of like biological analogy here that you use in the book You know, you talk about mice and elephants and other organisms that they consume more as they grow, but there is a limit at which the growth stops, right? An elephant gets only so big, and it is very big, but it can't continue to consume even more and get in even bigger at a certain point, whereas humanity can.
What you find is that animals, as they get bigger, only get slightly more efficient. But what you find in social systems is that it's a very different dynamic, because we do something that our bodies can't do, which is that we innovate to find a much greater efficiency improvement as we grow. So if you look at something like a city, as it gets larger, it doesn't slow down. You don't find the people in the city walking more slowly and taking more time over everything. You find the opposite. They walk faster, they talk faster, they meet with far, far more people, they have ideas faster, they innovate faster, and the whole thing spirals. And the end point is a kind of acceleration into that eventually gets infinite, which is, of course, impossible. So the whole thing crashes. Unless we do a reset on the whole kind of way that the system is operating.
So before we get to that reset, I want to talk a little bit more about this exponential growth. There's a moment that this kind of like smacks you upside the head, and it has to do with the number 1.8. Can you unpack that?
Yeah, so 1.8 is the long-term growth rate on emissions from fossil fuel use. And that's been going since about 170 years now.
Which is crazy. Nothing our economy doesn't grow that way. Nothing else sticks that close to a very, very consistent rate of growth like that.
And it's a jaw-stopping thing. Truly mathematically exponential curves don't happen by accident, right? You know, it's not a random thing. A true exponential curve is one which has a constant proportional growth rate, in this case, 1.8%. And you get exponentials anytime there is a kind of a dynamic that goes on that says growth begets growth. The bigger something gets, the faster it grows in a way that's unconstrained until something happens to make it crash. And if you look at that exponential curve over the 160 years, you do find kind of little blips in it. But we always rebound from those blips. So, you know, we went down a bit below the 1.8% for an oil crisis and some world wars and so on. But then whenever we do that, we've always followed that up with a period when we grow a bit faster than 1.8%. And if you look at the last few years, we've tapered things off a bit. And some people were getting very excited to say, oh, it looks as though we might be peaking our fossil fuel emissions. But actually, now we've got drill, baby, drill, and it looks like we're all set to, if we don't really watch it, we're all set to bounce back up above that 1.8%. So if we want to interrupt the dynamics of growth of fossil fuel, we actually need to do something at the global system level to interrupt that dynamic. And that actually turns out to be something very, very simple, but we don't talk about it anything like enough.
And what we're talking about here is reducing total energy demand.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in terms of the fossil fuel, we need to constrain it coming out of the ground. And the simplest way of doing that is to have a carbon price, a proper high carbon price. And then reducing energy demand linked to that makes it so, so much easier to cut the fossil fuel, because the climate doesn't care how many renewables we've got. It couldn't care less about that. What it cares about is how little fossil fuel we burn. And of course, the fossil fuel energy supply is the gap between the total energy demand and the renewables plus nuclear. So the more we reduce our energy demand, we make it so much easier to make sure that our renewables replace the fossil fuel instead of doing what they're doing at the moment, which is we're just having every year more renewables and more fossil fuel.
And we know this, right? We've tried, I mean, for decades and decades, you've wrote, you know, we've tried everything. We've tried personal change. We've tried protests. People have gotten themselves arrested on the streets. And you write that none of these things has so far delivered the change we need. So what is missing? And this sort of gets to the real heart of this book, to the title of this book. You know, we need to be pushing for honesty. And can you unpack that? Why, look, of all of the other things that we could be, should be, do, need to be doing right now, you've really honed in on this idea that the fundamental thing that is missing at this time and place to make this happen is truth.
Yeah. You know, we've been having climate COPs for 30 years now to try and get on top of the climate crisis. And, you know, you can draw a marker through that carbon emissions curve to mark the first one of those COPs. And you can't see any evidence at all that the curve has noticed that the COPs have been taking place, right? So year after year, we're just not getting there. Some people say we're making progress, but not fast enough. The basic facts are against them. We're not making progress. Every year we make the climate worse by a larger amount than we made it worse the year before. We are accelerating into the problem. And when I look at all the bad decisions that have been made around climate, including the failure of the COPs, I don't find poor judgment at their root. What I find is flat out deceit. So, you know, the reason why the COPs haven't got anywhere is because they have been very cynically, consciously, and cleverly led astray by the deceitful vested interests of the fossil fuel industry. And that's, you know, that's as clear as daylight, and it's very well documented now.
This is almost like our original sin in the climate crisis.
Yeah, and it's going on at every level. It's going on at the global level. But if I look in my own country now, we have discussions about whether to open up a new coal mine on my doorstep. And, you know, I look at the arguments for and against. And, you know, you find that the fundamental reasons, arguments for the coal mine were so dishonest. The people who put that together, you know, they knew that it was a load of nonsense. You know, they called it a carbon neutral coal mine because they ignored the emissions from using the coal, which is madness. You know, they said that if we open up this coal mine, other coal mines around the world will close down, so it won't lead to any more coal in the world. And, you know, no economist would ever agree with that. So it's all complete load of nonsense. And I can find example after example of arguments put forward to increase fossil fuel extraction that are just flat out deceitful. We have to have the best platform of honesty that we can get, actually higher than we've ever had, because the complexity of the problems is higher than ever. And the ease with which it's easy to spin an argument that looks plausible at face value, but is knowingly nonsense, is just greater than ever. We are accelerating into a polycrisis. And if we're going to get out of it, we need the highest quality decision making we can get. And if anyone's trying to pull the wool over our eyes on anything at all, we need them out of the decision making mix.
Well, this is really the central challenge, right? Because if it is true that what we need to solve this, as you say, polycrisis, is some fundamental agreement of the importance of truth. But we are living in this time in which the complexity of getting truth is becoming harder. And this really follows sort of a similar exponential curve to the one that we're seeing with carbon emissions, which is we have more information than ever. We have a greater efficiency of getting information, but that efficiency of getting information is not resulting in a resultant increase in accurate information getting into the hands of human beings.
Yeah, there's something going on here. Maybe it's analogous to the Jevons paradox. There's a kind of an irony in it that the more information we're getting, you'd think that would lead to a clearer view of reality. And actually, we're getting a more confused view of reality at the moment. So in this context in which there's so much information and we need the clearest view we can get, and there's so much complexity and there's so much inherent uncertainty in there as well, you know, how can we create a climate of truth? And my answer to that question is we have to create a really high price for deceit. And I think that's doable, because if you find that a politician, say, has deliberately deceived you over a matter of policy, just, you know, spinning any kind of narrative to make you try to understand the world in a way that is different from how they actually understand it themselves, then that tells you that they're not on your side, that they can't be trusted. It tells you that what they want is not your best interests. And you only got to find one example of them doing that. And that's all you need to know that they're not the right person to be in the job. But it also tells you that you actually can't trust any of their colleagues if they've stayed quiet in the clear knowledge that they were being deceitful. And if you apply that criteria to, you know, there's one or two political parties in the UK, which if you apply that criteria, you're not left with a single politician still standing, actually, at the moment. Things have got so bad.
Well, that's a real problem, right? Because, I mean, this example that you use is something similar to something that judges in the United States tell juries here, which I assume is probably true in the courts in the UK as well, which is that if a witness is dishonest in one way, you can assume that they are being dishonest in other ways as well.
And yet somehow, weirdly, on both sides of the Atlantic, we've slipped into, to varying degrees, we've slipped into normalizing the idea that, oh, all politicians lie, it's just how it's done. It absolutely isn't how it has to be done. And actually, the consequences of having routine dishonesty in our politics will come back to bite us very, very badly.
Well, this is a challenge of truth, right? Because we know what has happened in the past in terms of climate. So we have some truth there. What we are still working out as scientists is the truth of why those things have happened in the past to get us to where we are. We're getting better and better and better at that. And then if we look toward the future, right, as we model the future, there are many different possibilities. And so the truth is within the span of those, and nobody knows until we get there, of course. And so even a scientist can't stand there and say, I know what the truth of the future is. But we're getting better and better and better at it at the same time that we've had this explosion in information that allows people to find their own truths as well. It becomes very difficult to tell people, you know, hey, let's agree on a truth about the future. But that's what we need, because we have to, at this point, adapt proactively. We can't do it reactively. That'll be too late, as you say.
When I talk about the truth, it's kind of a shorthand for the best attainable version of the truth that we can achieve, right? Because there's uncertainty in this. That's a scientific reality. But within that, there are some things that we can be really very clear about, right? So the whole scientific community is crystal clear that climate change is a big deal that's going to affect a very large number of people. It's going to affect us all, and we need to do something about it. It's been clear about that for 30 years. So I quote the human rights campaigner James Baldwin here, and I say, because he said, not everything that can be faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. So what I'm saying is, we can't begin to start solving the problem until we look it properly in the eye. So when people say, you know, we're making progress on climate, but not fast enough, it's important to acknowledge that's not correct, right? We're not. We're accelerating into this polycrisis. And I'm not saying this to be depressing or doomy. I'm saying it because by staring the problem as it actually is in the face, we give ourselves, for the first time, a proper chance of starting to deal with it.
You say that there are times where we have come to these points of inflection where our world is at the precipice of a disaster of our own making, and we have figured out as an international community how to not make that happen. Can you unpack that?
Yeah, well, there are one or two examples of times when we have cooperated at the global level in order to fend off disaster. So the simplest, clearest one is nuclear war, right? So we have managed just about for many decades now to not have a nuclear war, despite the fact that it offers an efficiency improvement in terms of it's a very efficient way of killing people. And we've also held back from largely from chemical weapons and biological weapons, despite the efficiency improvements that they bring as well. Now, we succeed in those areas because it's so visceral, isn't it? We can really imagine how awful a nuclear war would be very, very easily. But imagining how climate might hit us is a lot more abstract. And imagining how climate and pollution and degradation of nature and the food system might all come together, that takes a lot more kind of abstract thinking. And so we need to get much better at doing something that we are capable of managing to do. So this is the Anthropocene challenge, really. So, you know, we need an urgent evolution of humanity in order to become fit to live well in this Anthropocene. And there's plenty of evidence from neuroscience and from history and from everywhere you look that we are capable of cultivating the values that we have to have in order to survive in any context, right? And right now, we need to develop some critical values without which we just can't thrive, right? We need to learn how to cooperate at the global level, which means we need to empathize with our fellow humans, all 8 billion of them, wherever they are in the world. And that's something we can learn. And we need to have this value of truth, which I've been banging on about. And we need to get much better at respecting the environment. But the evidence is that we are capable of cultivating those values through our own deliberate effort. And that's what we urgently need to do now. If you look at the psychology of humans coming to terms with difficult news, our natural reaction is often just to deny that it's happening. And then after that, we tend to get angry about it. And then we tend to try and bargain with the problem and hope it will agree to being a bit less serious than it really is. And then when that doesn't work, sometimes we get all depressed about it and we decide there's nothing we can do. And if we can go through all of those phases, we can take ourselves to the point where we accept the problem. We see it in all its richness and seriousness and depth. And we've got our sleeves rolled up and we realize we can have agency. There are things we can do to make the problem better. And it's at that point that we're actually able to make the most of the situation. And that's where we've all got to get to. Humans only feel good when we know we're doing the right thing. And right now, as societies, we know we're not doing the right thing, right? Deep down, this is nagging at us, right? It's gnawing away at us. We know we're heading for a bad place. And we just haven't quite got to the point of snapping out of business as usual and taking the action we need.
Well, it's really difficult, right? Because a lot of us as individuals feel we're very much stuck in a situation in which we are contributing to the problem. We know we're contributing to the problem. We know we could do better. Each one of us could do individually better. But then we learn that even if you live, and this is apparently true, even if you live as a Buddhist monk in a developed country, you're still very likely have a bit of a carbon footprint that is greater than what you should have. And so, you know, we all feel like we're part of the problem. And so that gets us stuck there in that sort of trough of depression.
Okay, so a few things to say about that. So the first thing is, it's no good beating ourselves up for our imperfections. It doesn't mean to say we should let ourselves off the hook. We should try and live responsibly, personally, and so on. That's fine. But, you know, you've got to enjoy life while you're at it. You've got to feel good about the attempts that you're making, flawed as they might be, to, you know, live a more responsible life, that's for sure. But that's not going to solve the problem. That's not enough to solve the problem. If you want to have proper agency on this, and this applies to all organizations and all individuals, you have to ask the question, what can I do to help create the conditions under which the global systemic change that we so urgently need can become possible? And that's a much more empowering question. And I think when you ask that question, and you also ask the question, what is my point of greatest leverage? Then that takes you to, what can I do to create a climate of truth, a truthful culture, a culture in which we treat deceit with the same disdain that we treat other forms of abuse?
That's Mike Berners-Lee. He's a researcher, author, and consultant on carbon footprint, sustainability, and climate change. And he's the writer of the new book, A Climate of Truth. Mike Berners-Lee, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio. And if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us then, you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University and from listeners like you. As Mike says, if you find your media credible, you should support it. And you can do that here at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.